First, I'd like to talk a little bit about the Irish famine, which many people would argue is not a true famine, because while it's accompanied by death, death in extraordinary numbers, it's the last of the great European famines. There's also a question whether one can legitimately call a disaster such as that a famine when, in fact, there is food available. It is a famine brought about by the failure of one crop, and in this day and age, that's one variety of one crop, the potato, which is, in fact, an extremely nutritious tuber. It was grown throughout Ireland for the two centuries or more prior to the 1840s, and it allowed the Irish population to increase and to develop, particularly in very rural and isolated areas. But because of extraordinary poverty, Ireland was the poorest country in all of Europe at that time, and there are many descriptions of it, de Tocqueville among them, going through saying that this is surely the poorhouse of Europe, and it was always considered incredible that the wealthiest country in Europe, with a vast empire across the globe, could have such a backwater area for a lot of reasons. The banning of exportation of some Irish products to decent markets, the lack of industrialization, absentee landlordism, and so on and so forth, built-in institutional discrimination against the majority by reasons of religion and history. Ireland had many, many problems. However, the population grew. And in the census in the 1 year, we take our census on the 0 year, in 1841, there was about 8.1 million Irish, according to the British government. Many people would argue that by 1845, this would have to be at least 8.5 million people, and that when you consider that 50% of those people spoke Irish, not English, as a first language, that the undercount must have been extraordinary. There's a book called The End of Hidden Ireland, which talks about the rural country people who speak nothing but Gaelic, live in areas that you don't hear that much about. County Roscommon, for example, had only one attorney for the entire county. It lived a simple agrarian life, great houses with absentee landlords, and then tenants. But under the tenants were the subtenants, and sometimes under them there were other subtenants, hangers-on, if you will, relatives, distant relatives, in-laws, who were allowed to live on the land. The true population, probably close to 9 million, a million people by 1845. In August of 1845, the crop that these people depended upon for survival failed. And the failure continued in 1846, 47, 48, 49, 50, and 51 were little better. And so the dates of the famine are not the 2 or 3 years that you used to read in your history books, but rather it lasted for approximately 6 years. At that point, the normal growth rate returned, although the pattern of emigration from Ireland continued, so that this nation of nearly 9 million was by 1900 a nation of 3 million, and that's the entire island, not north and south. And this essentially Gaelic-speaking nation with a very rich folk culture that went back to pre-Christian times, by 1900, only 10% of the people spoke Irish, and today probably 1% speak it as a first language, if that, and there are government subsidies to keep it alive, but the vibrancy of the language that was spread across the country is gone, and with it, much of the folk culture of Ireland. The people who left were the people, first of all, who were the subtenants. They were the day laborers, the small cottiers, the people that perhaps the big landlord didn't know even existed. The reaction of the British government was slow. It was incompetent. It was insensitive in many cases. And it didn't help that leading politicians in London made comments that this was God's punishment for the idolent Irish. It takes 25 times as much energy to develop lazy beds, which are the raised bed gardening, we'd call it, where you raise potatoes. And it's not done with a plow, it's done with a spade. And depending on what part of Ireland you're in, the design of the spade changes very differently depending whether it's rocky or clay soil or whatever. And yet the lazy beds were considered to be a lazy way of agriculture. even though it was far more difficult and labor-intensive for lazy people. The Irish at that time were considered by many to be literally a different race, a Celtic race and a backward race. And many people welcomed the opportunity to clear the land of people who lived everywhere in Ireland. Ronald Reagan, who is a product of the famine, his great-grandfather went to Britain and then to the United States. John F. Kennedy, we would not have him either. F. Scott Fitzgerald, Margaret Mitchell, you know, I'll never go hungry again. All of these people, Eugene O'Neill, so many people who have been talented in sports, in politics, in the cultural life of this country, would not exist today, at least not with the same gene makeup, myself included. A great many of the people you know who are today Irish and are successful in different fields and contributing to American life would not exist because their forebears never would have come to America. The bill passed by the New York State Legislature several years ago, mandating that the Irish famine be taught in the public schools of New York State, and they could do it for a very short time in 1 year out of 12, and that would meet the requirements. But that bill was put there because the Irish famine has been one of the great hidden parts of history for most Americans and to some extent even to people in Ireland for many, many years. If we did not have the famine, New York State would not be the same, nor would Albany be the same. It changed forever the demographics of America, and particularly of Albany and of New York State. Many of our cities became Irish cities almost overnight because of the famine. The famine in Ireland had an extraordinary effect on New York State. But to understand Albany's history, we have to go back to the fact that there were Irish here for literally generations, smattering of people back in the Dutch period, people who came over with the British Army. But the Roman Catholic Church was outlawed. It was against the law up until after the American Revolution. So in what Michael O'Brien, a longtime registrar of the American Irish Historical Society down in New York City, it's that limestone townhouse across from the Metropolitan Museum, used to write about was the hidden Irish and what they call the Scotch-Irish myth, that anybody was here, like General James Sullivan in the American Revolution, when a name that would come up that would obviously be Gaelic stock Irish, he would say, oh, well, they're Scotch-Irish, you know, because there weren't any Irish here until the famine. And that's called the Scotch-Irish myth. And while there would be disproportionately Ulster Scots who would come over here in the 1700s, probably on a 2-to-1 ratio in favor of Ulster Presbyterians versus Irish Catholics, there was nonetheless a very steady flow of Irish through all of the colonial times, but especially here in New York State. Without the presence of a Catholic Church, since the Catholic Church was forbidden, the opportunity to maintain one's culture and one's religion was minimal. There are stories of well-to-do merchants in New York City who would once a year travel to Philadelphia to make their Easter duty, to go to confession, to go to Mass and communion, and that would be it for a year. In Albany, we have a somewhat different history because of the Erie Canal. We had veterans of the Revolution, surely, and we had people who did maintain their identity. We have the second oldest Roman Catholic church, or congregation at least, in the state of New York. The first is 1684, and that's St. Peter's down on Barclay Street in Manhattan, paid for, by the way, by the Spanish crown. They demanded that a Catholic church be there for their diplomats, and since they had bankrolled the revolution along with the French who also fought in it, it was too embarrassing to say no. The second church, 1797, it's our own St. Mary's down here, and if you go down in the basement, you'll find that the basement of St. Mary's, which at one time was oriented toward the east, that's why they call it Chapel Street, used to have high steps up to that end of the church. That basement is still the same, and there's that 1797 with a skull and crossbones, for what reason I don't know, and two Irish names and a French name, and that congregation was established. And from that point on, people could maintain their identity, because religion and culture and ethnicity went hand in hand in those days. Prior to that, the earlier Irish would eventually marry into the Dutch, particularly into the Scottish Presbyterians and the Anglicans, and they would be lost giving the foundation for the Scotch-Irish myth later on, that if an Irish name showed up, even if it was a name like O'Brien or Sullivan, it'd be, oh, well, they must be Scotch-Irish. That would be because in the fourth generation, they, of course, would be Protestant, primarily through intermarriage. During the Erie Canal era, the Irish were prized, and in fact, many of them had worked as labor gangs building the canals of England. And they were recruited by DeWitt Clinton and by others. When it came time for the railroad, there's evidence of advertising by Erastus Corning, the first of the Erastus Cornings, and by Stephen Van Rensselaer for Irish labor to come over here in 1835. I think the amount of anti-Catholicism in the Dutch culture of Albany was rather minimal compared to places like Boston and in later years, Troy. Troy, early in the 20th century, actually had several Orange Orders, and they're the people where you have the forced marches through the Catholic areas in Ulster today. We never had an Orange Order, ever, in Albany. We had our problems, and we certainly had discrimination, but it was generally more tolerable. And that's because Erie Canal Irish, people like the Tracys, the Caggers, the Mahars, people who built St. Mary's Church and later on would do other great things. The Tracy family would wind up living in the Schuyler Mansion, always had a good relationship with the Dutch and later Yankee elite of Albany, New York. By 1830, 10% of the city was listed as being Irish. But don't forget, all these numbers are only including Irish-born people. Let me tell you, I'm Irish, and I'm here four or five generations, depending on which side you count. So when they give you these numbers, they're only telling you who's born there. When the famine came, the city was overwhelmed. Bill Rowley wrote an unpublished thesis, which is in the Albany Institute of History and Art, called Albany, A Tale of Two Cities. Bill is a former reporter, got his PhD over at the Urban Institute over in Harvard, studied under Oscar Hanlon, who was one of the first people to really put immigration and the immigrant's experience on the academic map. Bill Rowley has a wonderful publication there, and he describes the two cities, the parallel worlds, one being Protestant, Yankee, Dutch, their allies, and one being Irish Catholic and others who would consider themselves to be allies as well, and setting up parallel worlds. This comes later on. Prior to the famine, there was much more of a mix. And in fact, of the 10 seats on the Albany City Council, in those days they had both aldermen and assistant aldermen, two of them are Irish Catholics. This was unheard of in other cities. When the famine came, however, a different kind of Irishman showed up. These were not the people that made the fortunes on the Erie Canal. Not the people that owned the distilleries. Always remember, the cheapest way to send grain is to turn it into whiskey. And the breweries, and the warehouses, and the shipping. This was a different kind of Irishman. As with all immigration, you can be oversimplifying about it and say there are two kinds of immigrants. Those who come for the pull, that is the doors of opportunity, the lure of America, and those who come because of the push. The push people are different. They don't study to find out the best place to go. They don't write letters in advance. They get the hell out. And the same is true of the Palatines back in the early 1700s, the German Lutherans who just didn't fit in the British Empire and wound up coming to America. It's true of the Protestant French Huguenots. These are people who don't fit in the world they're in and have to get out. It's true of Jews from Eastern Europe, who, when the pogroms come, we all know about Anateca, the beloved little village, and the Cossacks come, and it's time to get out. And they don't ask, where am I going? They just say, get me out of here. How bad was the famine? They're the pull people, or they're the pushed people. The famine was so bad that within that five-year period, 1 million people died. They died of disease, and they died of starvation, because with starvation, with malnutrition comes disease. The diseases are typhus, typhoid. Typhus was called ship's fever. They were pushed into workhouses, a relatively new system in Ireland that had been going for probably 15 years before the famine. Originally, the British government set up work projects, building roads. Most of it was very heavy labor, which made no sense because there was no food to feed the people. They were reluctant to get involved in interfering with the private sector. And the first prime minister, in the beginning of the famine, bought what they called corn, which was, in fact, literally Indian corn, although the British call every grain corn. And they stored it so the people wouldn't raise the prices and profiteer. He lost his job. That was Robert Peel. And the next one, Lord John Russell, was brutal in his interpretation of how things should be done. The landlords, who were forever in debt in Ireland and were often absentee, though not always, the landlords were billed for the famine. And the law that went in 1847 said that if someone was a tenant of yours and they showed up at the workhouse, you got the bill. Now, these are impoverished people who can't, are living beyond their means. They're trying to maintain a home in London, particularly since they moved the capital there in 1801. Dublin used to have its own parliament. That was gone by then. And they're well beyond their means, and they can't collect their rents. And a lot of the people on their land don't pay rent anyway because they're being sheltered by relatives in these primitive clusters of houses called clachans, without a church, a pub, a school, any of the things that you and I would call them villages. Most of them, that's hidden Ireland. They speak nothing but Irish. They don't show up on the rolls. Now you've got a problem. If people show up at the workhouse, you get the bill. So what did the landlords do? The landlords started evicting people. They turned out the people that didn't belong and sent them onto the roads, and they slept in the ditches. Because of the drainage, there are great ditches in Ireland. Meanwhile, there's work projects going on, building useless walls around estates just to make work because the government considers it morally wrong to give people free food. They have to work for it, even though they're literally starving. 500,000 people, 500,000 people, were formally evicted during the famine. Other people did other things. They took what little money or credit they had, they were landlords, and they gave a one-way ticket to America. But not the America that people wanted to go, to Canada. Because, first of all, Canada needed people. And also, America had had scandals in shipping in the 1830s. And there were congressional investigations, and there were reforms, cleaning up the packet ships, allowing a certain amount of sanitary of space and of sanitary care for people who came over in ships. And so the price of a ticket to America went up. And with it, the desire for people who just wanted to get people off their land, relieve themselves of the liability, clear the land later on, particularly for grazing, it was cheaper to buy a one-way ticket to Canada. If anybody here has ever been to Grosse Isle, Grosse Isle is not the Ellis Island of Canada. It's up near Quebec City. It is the place where you put the sick people. And when your boat comes in, you check it out. If somebody has ship's fever, you can quarantine all of the boat or just part of the boat. And the graves there, if you go up, they've got nice little white crosses, a few score, a few dozen of them. Actually, they haven't marked all the graves. There are literally thousands of people on this Isle of Tears called Grosse Isle. 25,000 people, it's felt, died at sea and were just thrown overboard. The ships that were used, which are still known today as coffin ships, because some of them, there's examples of some of them literally sank on the way over with people on the shore watching these unwieldy vessels, had been used in the slave trade, which had been abolished a good generation before. There were also lumber ships, because you would bring lumber from Canada over to Great Britain and Ireland, and then you'd bring people back. They weren't the best, and some of them were surely the worst. Most of the Irish that I know in Albany don't have a strong sense of the famine. And I always used to say to people, you know, when did your people come here? Oh, I don't know, in the 1800s. And I'd say, was it your grandfather? No, it was his grandfather. It was his father. And I'd say, so when did they come? I don't know, the 90s, the 80s? Well, think about it. When was your father? Well, you know, it must have been earlier. Huge number of people are descendants of famine refugees. By 1855, and I just looked at the 1855 census today in preparation for this talk, by 1855, there were 25,000 Irish in the city of Albany. They were half the city of Albany. They were the majority in the city of New York. Germans, 30 years later, would be the majority group. And there are Germans here as well, because 1848 is a disruptive year in Europe, and many people get out. With failed revolutions, they come here and start a new life in America. But the Irish that come here are the people that are being pushed, not the people that are being pulled by opportunity. By 1855, in Know-Nothing America, in that census, we find that Albany's number one religion is Roman Catholic, and 80% of those people will be Irish, the rest of them primarily German. The city will have five Catholic churches. Holy Cross will be German. The others will be overwhelmingly Irish Catholic. Today we're celebrating the 150th anniversary of the dedication of the cathedral, and there'll be a formal mass this Saturday. And that's where we have to mention, how do people react? Well, we had had, I felt, from my studies, a relatively tolerant view of Irish immigrants. Anti-Catholicism, but then that was 19th century America anyway. And the Dutch had learned, because of the Dutch roots in the city, they had learned to get along with other groups, whether reluctantly or willingly, for literally a century or two. So it was a better place to be than some of the other places in America. But you remember when Ross Perot ran in 1992, and people made the comment that it was the second highest turnout for a third party in American history since what year? 1848, the Know-Nothing Party. That was the biggest. Because in 1848, the number of people, the backlash of people coming from Ireland and from Germany, people with a different culture, a different language. Don't forget, 50% of them are speaking Irish. Those that speak English don't speak it particularly well, a great many of them. Resentment against Catholics. Because of this, in 1848, you begin to get a tremendous backlash. In 1847, the number of Irish that have come here, before it was just the Erie Canal Irish, people that built the railroad, small, manageable clusters, and in general, industrious people who were needed in an America with a labor shortage. Now the place is overwhelmed. Overwhelmed with people from the backcountry without urban skills. Many of them broken in terms of their physical and their mental health. The average lifespan of a famine immigrant is 7 years getting off the boat. A good deal for their children and their grandchildren, surely. But for the actual famine immigrant, there's extraordinary suffering. And also, as you can imagine, they're not of tremendous use to the labor market at that time. The Mexican War is going on. Albany sent a group called the Republican Guards down to the Mexican War. A lot of people joined in the Mexican War. And in fact, we executed, primarily because of anti-Catholicism, more soldiers for desertion in the Mexican War than we did in the Civil War, World War I, World War II, Vietnam, Spanish-American War combined. And the overwhelming of the majority of them were Irish Catholics. If you do any Mexican history, you know about the San Patricios, who deserted based on religious grounds, because churches were being desecrated. They looked at the war as they were in American uniforms, that it was something to switch sides, because it was an attack on the church and not an attack of one country against another. We lost one-third of our privates. We sent down, in, I think, 210 privates, and 70 of them died. The gold rush, another opportunity. That's why San Francisco is very different from Los Angeles. It's a famine city, because young people looking for opportunity, they wind up in San Francisco. And for a very long time, despite the West developing late, as you know, Los Angeles, if it's 1920, it gets an historic site sign. San Francisco has a different history, because it's a product of the famine. The Diocese of Albany in 1847 was established, and also the Diocese of Buffalo, because of this enormous increase in population. I read that 1855 census today, and the cathedral had a capacity of 1,800 seats, and believe me, that was packing them in. We wouldn't use that number today. It must have been thinner. And a lot of people stood in the back because the way you paid for churches is with pew rents. They admitted to having 1,500 actual communicants, that is, members of the parish. The average weekly attendance was 2,000. Who are these other people? These are immigrants. A lot of the work was done by volunteer labor, but most people had to take every nickel they had and send it back to get other relatives out of Ireland. You never heard about it, maybe academically, but you didn't talk about the famine. You might say Irish 25 times a day in your home, but you didn't say famine, and you knew there was a potato famine, but you didn't know the details. She said it's the same way in Ireland, because it's taken 150 years to talk about it. We don't talk about it because we survived by stealing food or keeping food from starving neighbors. You don't talk about it because you left your old and your weak behind. There is a national shame, a survivor's guilt within the Irish character over the issue of the famine. I got in at 3 o'clock this morning. That's when I went to bed. I got in a little after midnight after 4 days in Mexico on the border in the area where the maquiladoras, the factories, are built. And I spent every one of those days up in a slum that none of us would stay in for more than a few hours, where people build their houses with cardboard boxes and with pallets for lifting heavy things, the type that the forklifts lift. I went to Mass in a, we picked up one priest at a church that had no roof and was nothing but cement block, and where the people were indigenous people. They were Indians from the south of Mexico. Then we went to the one that had the roof, and it wasn't much better, but it wasn't much better. And I looked at these people with their dirt floor and a building that would make most garages look like a palace, and I said, these are my people. The only thing that's different is the time. I no longer say that half my mother's family, half my father's family came over during the famine. And I don't use the term famine immigrants anymore. They're famine refugees. They put extraordinary strain on the society. You're going to hear in a little while how some of the society, the proper Protestant part of society, actually rose to the occasion. And it was for many of them their shining hour. You always hear about no Irish need apply. Albany had a somewhat different history and, in fact, had a big heart. I went up and read that census. And, you know, there's always a thing, you know, these immigrants, we came here, we pulled ourselves up by our own bootstrap, and why these people can't do it, I can't imagine. Well, let's go back, in my case, 4 generations, and in most people's case, 5 generations. The almshouse in Albany in that 1855 census had 301 people in it. That's the poorhouse. 118 of them were Irish, 30 were German. St. Vincent's, which we'd call LaSalle School on Western Avenue, had 3 brothers. One was a Canadian, 2 were born in Ireland, and a French chef. 62 boys. Every one of them had Irish names. The penitentiary, well, let's take the city jail. You know, you're in and out of there in a matter of weeks or months. Had 201 people. That was the jail over on Eagle Street on the corner of Howard Street. Of the 201 in the jail, 49%, 98 out of 201, were Irish. In the penitentiary, now you're in for a year or more, that's where Hackett Junior High School is, 208 people, and 102 of them were Irish, only 14 were German, in case you're comparing with other contemporary immigrants. The almshouse, the deaths, and written on the bottom of it, most of the people were brought here to die. In the almshouse, half the adults were Irish who died. 30% of the children. Why? Because some children are born here, so they don't show up as Irish. When the Irish came in cholera years, 1849, 1854, they would be headed off by the Albany County Sheriff's Department, herded onto Green Island, where a lot of it was largely open space, or in Washington Park. Because remember, a lot of them came down from Canada. Cheap passage, all the way down, the ones halfway, they're the ones with the bad feet that couldn't make it down, right? And those little settlements up there, they don't come from Boston. They made it halfway down. They would be held there every August because August was fever month. Remember when you were a kid, you couldn't go out on polio, they wouldn't let you swim on August in public pools. Same thing. That's when all of the cholera and the epidemics hit. They would hold them there in tent camps, and if at the end of August they were still alive, then they could come into the city. There was fear of disease. There was resentment. There was some tremendous pressure. The reaction of the church, who had to build Victorian, respectable churches because a lot of the anti-Catholic business had raised its ugly head where it had been very controlled, at least in our area. You had to have a respectable church. Try building that in the middle of a famine. And believe me, a lot of corners were cut that we're still paying for today. Orphanages had to be set up. Take a look at the date of the founding of orphanages. They're almost always the same year that we had a cholera epidemic because of the number of orphans and half-orphans that are left. It's a tremendous period, and it was a time when Albany was strained in every direction. For generations, the Irish hold every position that they want in business and in not-for-profits and surely in politics. And I think there's a message of hope in that, and I would close with that message of hope. And the people add to America and increase its value and the richness of its culture in the long run. Thank you.